This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today on the program, we air an Informed Decision 2020 panel on housing in Utah, the shortage of available units, the rising prices, and how COVID-19 has affected the state's market. Prior to this year, Utah had an estimated 50,000 unit deficit in available housing. During the first months of the pandemic, the Utah housing market saw a slowdown driven by uncertainty of both buyers and sellers, as well as the federal moratorium on evictions. Now, Utah is again seeing high demand and increasing prices due to pent-up demand, a rise in out-of-state migration, and the end of the eviction moratorium. Today's panel takes a closer look at how this year's global health crisis has affected Utah's housing market, housing prices, and the shortage of units. The panelists include Michael Gallegos, Director of Housing and Community Development for Salt Lake County, Jonathan Hardy, Director of Utah's Housing and Community Development Division, and Jim Wood, Ivory Boyer Senior Fellow at the Kem C. Gardner Policy Institute. Moderating the discussion is Natalie Gochner, Director of the Gardner Policy Institute. This forum was put on in partnership with the Gardner Policy Institute and the University of Utah's Political Science Department. This forum was recorded on September 30th, 2020. Here is your moderator, Natalie Gochner.
Mike and Jonathan and Jim, I'm going to make a few comments just to kind of tease the issue, and then I'm going to open it up to some of your comments. It's clear from the research that I've seen that over the last decade in the state of Utah, significantly more households have formed than housing units have been built. This has resulted in a housing shortage of approximately 53,000 housing units. New housing units continue to be concentrated in communities with available land. With this comes growing pains, which has led to NIMBYism, making it even harder to find homes. In terms of construction, COVID-19 has had little to no impact on the market. For the first six months of 2020, the number of residential building permits issued was at an all-time high of nearly 14,000. While this is really good news, the number of available existing for-sale homes is down 52%. And this lack of inventory, paired with low mortgage rates and pent-up demand, have pushed home prices up nearly 8% since May. So we've got our hands full, and I'm so happy to have Jonathan Hardy, who knows this from a state government perspective, Mike Gallegos, who knows it from our capital county, our largest county, Salt Lake County, and Ivory Boyer Senior Fellow Jim Wood. Jim, I'm going to go to you first and just ask, when did we start seeing this housing shortage in Utah? And maybe you can elaborate a little bit more on the major causes.
Well, I think, first of all, it's thanks to the Hinckley Institute. This is terrific. Love to participate in this. And as Natalie said, housing is an important issue. The chamber took a survey 2 years ago of the top issues in Utah, surveying households, and housing was at the top of the list, ahead of air quality, transportation, and even education. They're all lumped there. I think housing is equal to all of those in terms of an important issue. This housing shortage, we really didn't see it until 2014, 2015, and that was because we had a lot of vacancies coming out of the Great Recession, both in owner-occupied units as well as rental units. And so those vacancies really absorbed some of that excess in households over new housing units. But it was about, as I said, probably 4 or 5 years ago where we could see evidence of a housing shortage. Now it is, the shortage is something less than 53,000 we see now. Those 53,000 aren't out on the street. Just to give you context, it's we have about 1 million households in Utah. So that's about 5%, but it's probably somewhere now, the shortage between 25 and 30,000 units to be a healthy housing market. And what's happened is we've driven down the vacancy rate, then we have higher rates of doubling up. And that's what, actors in the market have turned to and how the market has adjusted. but we still have a housing shortage, and I can talk about that next in a little bit more detail, Natalie.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Jim. Just setting it up here. So we had a lot of vacancies that we put down that vacancy rate, and now you're estimating 25 to 35,000 still shortage.
Yeah, I think, well, you know, these household numbers and how they're produced, and we have also that number comes from our office as well as the housing construction. And another way I really like to look at it is the households are, those are estimates. But what does it look like on the ground? The people who are working in the real estate market and residential construction. And there are three points of entry for anyone trying to get into the housing market. First of all, they can buy an existing home, or they can buy a new home, or they can rent. And in all three points of entry, we still see a stress in the market. For example, in the existing home market, days on market is now 19 days. So a home that goes on sale is pretty much closed. I don't know if it's closed, but it's pending after 19 days. And the shortest period of time we had was 2 years ago, 3 years ago. It got down to 17 or 16 days. Typically, if you go back several years, we're talking 40, 50 days. Mm-hmm. So what we have is existing home market, the realtors are really happy. Then in the home building market, as one of the largest builders in Utah described it the other day, it's a frenzy. It's more active than what he saw with D.H. Horton, a big company, second largest home builder in Utah, is even more robust than it was leading up to the Great Recession. And then last, the rental market, what does that look like? It's still under stress. We have 9 consecutive years in Salt Lake County with the rental rate below 4%. That's an unhealthy market.
Yeah. Okay, Jim, you have laid it out well. Mike Gallegos, I'm going to come to you next, because when I hear Jim talk, and he and I both share the title economist in our background, but when I hear of a shortage, what I want to see is supply. I want to see more, you know, housing units built. And in Salt Lake County, you know, we've seen resistance to building, and I'm thinking of the Olympia Hills project in Southwest Salt Lake County. I'm just wondering how you view the balance between the need for more housing and people's reluctance to want to see it in their own neighborhood.
Yeah, you bring up a good topic of discussion there. It is a difficult conversation to have when you're looking at the need of housing, and primarily affordable housing. And the area that Salt Lake County still has a role in as far as land use is the unincorporated piece of Salt Lake County, primarily on the west side, on the foothills of the Ochre Mountains, which is where Ochre Hills is to be located. And is a location where we're going to see growth in the future. And so as we look at that growth, is looking at the issues that transportation and growth that bring to mind to a lot of people that already live on the west side of Salt Lake County. The things that we have to look at and plan for is how do you create a mixed development that's going to also provide employment on the west side to try to reduce travel to west to east and some south to north. However, if we look at the transportation plans, which is going to look at increasing opportunities for the increased traffic, is again trying to make nodes of employment opportunities there on the west side as well.
Yeah.
So we have to look at economic development, transportation, housing, all have to come together as far as overlaying the plans to try to address those issues that comes up with growth. It's not going to go away. We just have to make sure that we're educating our public and how that occurs.
It's interesting that Jim mentioned it, but you can't talk about housing without talking about land use, without talking about transportation, and ultimately you'll get to air quality.
That's right. That's right on. I think as we look at housing now, I think all of us are talking about, when we talk housing, we're also talking about health, health of families and health of our environment. And we can go back to several years ago in partnership with the Institute. The Jim was part of this, and that was our Sustainable Communities Regional Planning opportunity to lay the groundwork on how we proceed on the growth of the Wasatch Front.
Right. Jonathan, so you work in the Utah Department of Workforce Services. You have a large portfolio there, but you help a lot with affordable housing issues. I would love you to share with our viewers what happened in 2019 with Senate Bill 34, which, as I understand, helped incentivize affordable housing at the city level. Tell our viewers what that was and give us an update on what's happening.
So Senate Bill 34 strengthened the code in Utah to require municipalities and counties to develop a moderate income housing plan. There was always a requirement to do it, but this bill tied the state's transportation dollars. We talk about overlaying all these plans, transportation plans, that cities are required to do a number of plans. But they wanted to make sure that there was a housing component with that. So it required cities to choose from a minimum of three, some communities have to do at least four, of a menu of 26 available items to address housing affordability in their communities under this moderate income housing plan. So by December 1st of 2019, all of these municipalities and counties that fit this population requirement, basically any entity over 5,000 in population, had to submit this type of moderate income housing plan to the state for review. And really, that's the first step. They just laid out their plans, and then by December 1st of this year, they're going to have to report on their progress on those plans. So it's really laying the groundwork to respect local zoning and ideas on how communities want to grow, but also keeping in mind, how are they going to address moderate income housing as part of that growth, if that's a staple in there. And to be eligible for that, any of those transportation dollars, and this is, you know, $700 million on the table annually, that they have to be a participant and making progress on that plan. So that's a big step forward for our communities.
Right. Jonathan, just to make sure I understand it. So requires a moderate income housing plans. It's tied to transportation funding. So there's a bit of a stick there that wasn't there in the past. Has the stick been used at all, or are we just too early in the process?
We're a little early, but I will say what we've seen result-wise is we have 100% compliance from municipalities that are required to submit these plans, which we didn't have before. So far, so good on the plans. As far as the results of seeing the housing, I think those are the things we're going to see from here forward when we get reports back to see if we're all these plans, you know, they're not any good unless you implement them. So we want to see the implementation of that. We're a little early in that process, but that's what we'll be looking for going forward.
Jim, I want to ask you, I know that zoning is an issue here in terms of allowing new units, density issues. Where do you see opportunities for improvement in the zoning, application in our state?
Well, yes, zoning is really, I think, the most important. It's the one place where cities and the state and counties can intervene on housing prices. Don't have much leverage on labor prices, don't have much leverage on land prices or materials. But in terms of zoning, there is a fair amount of leverage, but it is guarded closely by the local communities. They want to be in charge of that. And so that's where the issue of NIMBYism comes in. Usually that is surrounding zoning issues for a new project. And If we are going to change the direction or the trajectory, just temper it a bit, the upward of prices, upward pressure on prices, we need more high density. And of course, that comes to zoning. And right now, we are at record levels of high density housing, which is really a good thing. Last year, we had almost 10,000 multifamily units in Utah out of 25,000 new units. So, and the apartment boom is a reflection of that. And in the aggregate, those numbers are great. If you look at on the community level, you'll find that Salt Lake City is a real strong participant in high density housing, and other communities do not want high density housing in their neighborhoods for the typical reasons. But it again, to get high density housing, you're probably going to have to change some zoning. Mm-hmm. And they don't want, residents don't want high density because they believe, ultimately, they believe that it's, and it, sometimes it might not be expressed, but it's going to have some impact on their housing values. And they don't want, they'll say it's because of increased transportation, increased transient neighborhoods, which affects the schools. We got lighting and we got crime. So those are the, just the high density itself. We are in the process right now, and Mike, you'll be happy to hear we're getting close, and we're doing this project for Mike on the impact of high density apartment developments on surrounding real estate values in Salt Lake County. And Dayan is working on that, and he gave me a little bit of an update. I don't want to speak until we get final numbers, but those will be some interesting numbers. Because that issue comes out in so many city council meetings, planning commission meetings, about what's this going to do to my housing values. So zoning is really, it's the mother load of all practices. It's so important.
Yeah, you know, and anytime you're dealing with property rights, that's a tricky thing.
Yeah. Being a former planning commissioner member, I understand those arguments that we've gotten all throughout the years. And it'll be good to go beyond just using anecdotes about the reason why not to. Mm. And as a planning commissioner, I had experienced a lot of NIMBYism, but also the fact that if you look at the growth of multifamily housing, it's not keeping up with the number of units that are needed for affordability. If you look at the numbers of market rate housing rental units compared to affordable housing units, it's not balanced correctly. And so that's part of, I think, the municipalities and their planning commissions need to be aware of, and how you look at developing a community that has a mix of income besides housing types.
That was Michael Gallegos, Director of Housing and Community Development for Salt Lake County. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. On this program, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them, mostly unedited, in their entirety as a public service. Today, we are airing an Informed Decision 2020 panel on Utah housing and the issues of unit shortages, rising prices, and the coronavirus pandemic. Here again is your moderator, Natalie Gochner.
I'll talk about the rental market for a minute. And Jonathan, I know that there's been some state aid that's been set aside to help with rental assistance. I don't know a lot about it. Isn't it $24 million or so that that the state has put out there to help for in-need rental families? Can you just highlight that a little bit and help us understand that?
Sure. Really a short-term help for people that are struggling related to COVID-19 that is happening right now. So a lot of this is
so let the record show, we got 24 minutes into this before coming up with COVID. The longest I've gone.
So the, you know, a lot of this money, $20 million of it is CARES Act money that has to be spent by December 30th. So we have two programs operating right now that are helping out. One that renters can apply to directly statewide. If you've been negatively impacted. So this could either be a reduction of income, or you've had increases of expenses related to COVID-19, you are eligible to apply for rental assistance, and it can help up to $2,000 per month. And we can even go back and help prior months if you've got this lagging behind. And this is something we'll probably get into a little bit with some of the eviction moratorium protections that are now out there from the CDC. That doesn't mean people don't have rental obligations to take care of at some point, and we would rather take care of them now, and that's why this pool of money is out there. So on the renter side, we can help out. We also have a landlord program where landlords can apply on behalf of the renters that kind of face these same situations. So that sometimes is easier to batch a bunch of folks together for landlords, and we can make direct payments. All these payments go directly to the landlords and ensure that people are not in danger of eviction and are keeping current with their obligations. And I think it's also important to point out that landlords need to get paid as well. Just because we have an eviction moratorium out there does not mean there aren't expenses related to maintaining properties and other things that rely on that rental income. So we're excited about that $20 million program, although it does run out December 30th. And then we have some additional programs that can last a little longer than that. That's the other $4
million. What's the utilization of the $24 million? Do you still have a lot left?
Yes. So we're about $3.5 million in.
That's a problem for me, right? Because it's October 1st tomorrow.
Yes.
What is the state going to do if you've only spent $3 million of 24 and it's got to be spent by December 31st?
So the landlord program has really only been going for like a couple weeks, and it's starting to get about $100,000 in claims per day. So we feel like that's, if we can sustain that trajectory, we can get quite a few dollars out the door. The renter side is something that we are keeping our eye on, maybe shifting some. We have a variety of agencies doing this statewide, so we will probably shift to different areas that have spent out their funds. And that's an option for us as well to make sure that we get that $20 million spent.
Got it. So I want to remind our viewers that we're taking questions. I can see a few coming in. So keep them coming, and we'll go there in a minute. Jim and Mike, do you want to comment on this COVID-19 response for renters, landlords? Jim, are you seeing the things that you'd like to see in the face of an economic crisis, or should the state and the county and cities be doing more?
Well, I think it's what we've seen to this point is that the landlords, they haven't had a spike in evictions, and rent collections are among the best in the country in Utah. And a piece I did for Salt Lake City hand office, I surveyed, it was actually the county, Mike, I surveyed about 70 projects regarding COVID-19 and rent collections. And I asked the manager or the landlord, and this totaled 90 projects, about 18,000 units. And they were all above, the projects were all above 25 units. I didn't want to survey homes or duplexes or whatever, but And we have a database on the larger units. So that made it easy. And I ask each one how COVID-19 affected or impacted their rent collections. And I gave them a scale, one being very large impact, two large impact, three moderate, four slight, five no impact. The weighted average of all of those units or projects was 3.8, so just under slight impact. Much better than I thought.
And when did you do that, Jim? What was the month of that?
The month?
Yeah.
That was in September.
So it's real recent. Okay.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And some of them did know. Originally in April and May, we had some problems, but not any longer. So only one project reported very large impact. So, but I got a caution on this because that's on the landlord side. And renters seem to be, and of course they had the benefit of the $1,200 early on and also the $600 weekly bump in UI insurance. So that really provided a cushion. And then probably a lot of renters have scrambled, I would guess, in July, August, and maybe September. The question that we don't have an answer to is, has the renter exhausted their resources? Now, Jonathan's programs are going to help, but and just we've got almost 300,000 renters in the state. In the four Wasatch Front counties, we've got 92,000 renters who are low income and have a housing cost burden. So they're all possible renters who really have the potential of some sort of housing insecurity and stress because of COVID-19.
They are at risk.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, Mike, I'd love to hear you comment on how COVID-19 has affected affordable housing, low-income Utahns in Salt Lake County. What are you seeing?
Well, with regards to COVID-19, I'm a little closer to what's happening on the ground with the work that we're doing here with the county. I just got off a call before this meeting with the number of individuals that were going over our weekly contact to see where things are at with the health department, their work out in the community, with other groups that are working on food insecurity. And as with regard to the rental assistance, major portion of this, or at least the need for this, is to keep people housed who have been exposed to COVID, right? Don't go back to work if you have COVID. But we see that people have gone back to work because they can't afford not to. So it's accessing those people and communities that there is this resource available. And so that's most important. And I think we could pretty much say we're on a second wave of COVID with what's happening most recently. Yeah. So with regard to affordable housing, the impact there, it is most people that are in affordable housing units probably don't have the luxury as much as others do to work from home, or probably don't work in occupations that allow them to do that. And they're the ones that are vulnerable. And our efforts are to reach out to those households. And as part of housing assistance, it is good health. It's protecting the families. It's protecting everyone else in our communities.
Yeah.
So, with regard to, affordable housing, there's still a demand. There are still projects that are submitting requests for funding. I think the applications for tax credits is up now for this coming year, and we'll see what's out there.
That was Michael Gallegos, Director of Housing and Community Development for Salt Lake County. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. In this final segment, the panel answers questions from the virtual audience. Once more, here is your moderator, Natalie Gochner.
Okay, I'm going to move us to sort of a, I'm going to call it a rapid fire panel response to some of these questions that are coming in. And I'll ask the question, and if you have something to say on it, maybe you can just give me a nod and we'll go there. The first one is, how do developers deal with NIMBY mentalities? Has NIMBYism increased over the years? Who wants to tackle that one?
Yes, it has increased.
Okay, it's increased. And how do developers deal with it? What are you seeing? I'm familiar with some of these, but...
Well, maybe Mike's better at that, but it's just negotiations back and forth. I was on a panel a year or two ago with the developer of Oak Hills, and it was really interesting. He's not tech savvy. He said he had no understanding about really social media. They had approval for the project from the planning commission and the council, and he was ready to move on it. Then the word got out, and within he didn't know social media, but within 10 days, because of social media, there was an uprising in Harriman about the project. And of course, in the end, the mayor decided we need to study a little bit more, and it went back. But social media has increased NIMBYism. Yeah. And, you know, it's a case-by-case basis, I think, on how it's dealt with. Might have better.
There have been projects that have been canceled or pulled by the developer, even though they had the support from the Planning Commission. And when it got to the legislative level of the councils, they had the legal right to move forward because they were within the zoning to do the project, and could have fought it and won. But their take was on it, if they do it, they're going to have trouble trying to get approvals in other cities. Hmm. So they felt that trying to force the issue was going to be detrimental for their business going forward. And so they felt sort of like they were forced to pull it out, but they could have won it. Just that they didn't want to have that type of exposure and moving forward.
Especially in an environment where they have a lot of other opportunities for how to spend their capital that can get a higher return for them.
I think it's also important. This is where the zoning and the moderate income housing plans really come into play. I mean, in theory, this is really what you should do at a municipal level, is plan where you want it, zone it. Then the developers have the right to develop it as properly zoned. I think that's the fallback for a lot of people to move forward on projects. It's very difficult in these, when you're trying to do an overlay type development that is totally subject to a planning commission's and a city's desire of what they want to see there. If you have more zoning by right, then you have, and that's what should be mentioned in these types of plans, then you have opportunities to develop it despite this opposition. And it's unfortunate. It's been a way of life for a long time, I think, like anything. Because it's so proliferated on social media, we see a lot more about it right now. But a lot of our growth is all internal. I mean, I have kids myself that are entering the housing market, and it is very difficult. And this is not like somebody from California moving in. This is, how do they form their own household and exist in our community because they have jobs? And, what does that look like going forward? I think that is a real struggle for our state right now.
Jonathan, that's where I'm going next with our next rapid fire question. But you look too young to have kids in the housing market. I'll just go on record saying that. A person's asked, can you speak to the first time homebuyer experience here in Utah? And the color commentary is, Jim, you mentioned, 19 days on the market, biggest decision of their consumer decision of their life. you know, it just feels so hard, even with low mortgage interest rates, for these young households to find the right place and then to be able to afford it and make a smart decision for their family.
Is that to me or John?
Yeah, I think so. I'm looking at you, Jim, on my screen. So go ahead. I just, Jim, you're like the smartest, you know, housing construction, most experienced housing construction real estate analyst in our state. You've got a young home buyer that's trying to figure out, what do they do? Where do they purchase now? Where do they purchase? What should be going on in their minds as they're making this important decision?
Well, my advice always is to purchase now. But I'm not a financial advisor, but if for my grandkids, yeah, get in as soon as you can, particularly with where interest rates are now. But if you look at just Salt Lake County, in 2015, the typical mortgage payment for the median price home, okay, the median price home that was sold was $1,300. 5 years later, in 2020, that typical mortgage payment to afford the median price home in Salt Lake County is a little over $2,000, an increase of 56%. That is exactly double what household income in Salt Lake County has increased over those 5 years. So, and that analysis includes the benefit of interest rates. Although the interest rates weren't that much different in 2014 than they are now. Yeah. But anyway, that just gives you an idea of declining affordability in our market. And it's not going to change. We've got really rapid levels of growth. I expect that's going to continue. And that drives the prices.
Yeah. Mike, are you in the same camp that you say purchase now, get in as early as you can?
Yes. At one time, to buy a house and have a mortgage, it was as equal or less than a house payment. Now it's reversed, where the price of housing is exceeding the cost of rents. And so it's a struggle for young households to, first of all, save for the down payment.
Yeah.
And then to qualify for the mortgage. So yes, I'm in the same camp as what Jim has said. Myself personally, I have a rental which I am selling to my son because he has a young family. He's not going to be able to come up with a down payment. Father is going to have to subsidize his down payment.
Yeah.
And I do it because his family and has young kids that are going to need that type of security. So yeah. It's what
Jonathan,
you do.
Are you in the same camp?
Yeah. I'll put this caveat out there. I think we are lower interest rates have created a larger pool of available buyers for the inventory. And that is a challenge on prices. And if interest rates were to go up, that pool shrinks a little bit. I agree with Jim. We're just not producing enough housing to see housing prices go down. But that I've talked to a builder who said their average buyer with interest rates now can afford $200,000 more of a home than they did before. And, you know, the available units out there are the same. So you're just increasing, you know, pools of available buyers for units. And it's really putting some real stress. I mean, all the stress Jim talked about is really exacerbated. I think it'll cool down a little bit if interest rates, but who knows where interest rates are going anytime soon. I mean, that's a big question mark as well. So in general, I am in the camp that get in because here in Utah, we're just not producing enough to cool off anything at the housing price level.
So, you know, what I hear the three of you talking about alluding to is these supply constraints and the zoning affects that. Let's talk for just a minute about labor supply of land, and supply of materials. And Jim, I'll come to you. We have someone asking how the construction of the airport and the inland port will affect housing prices. And I think the issue there is competition for labor and for supplies. How would you respond to that?
Well, the airport is winding down over the next few years. Labor supply for construction has been an issue for the last 7 or 8 years, and material costs have moderated a bit, with the exception of lumber. At least that's what I hear from most of the builders. But the inland port, in my mind, and this might, I don't know, we've never talked about this, Natalie, but even though we're in the same building, and you did a report on this. But the inland port, it kind of reminds me of, say, smaller efforts, University of Utah Research Park, and then the Freeport Center, and they take a long time to develop. Mm-hmm. And so it will be, the inland port in my mind will be several years. We'll see incremental changes in terms of demand for supply and labor, but it does not represent, I don't think, a real spike. It will be incremental, and the market will adjust. And what it means for housing and housing costs, that's part of the growth. I think Tooele County is going to be advantageous for a lot of those workers. It's relatively low housing prices, and it's not a very long commute, 20, 25 minutes. So we're going to see, I think, a little bit more dispersion in where people live, given the Northwest Quadrant development. And that's going to benefit home buyers who can get more affordable housing 20 minutes away.
Right. Jonathan, you and I have been working a little bit on homeless services in our state. We have someone who's asked a question: has homelessness increased during the pandemic? So I'll let you answer that. And then secondly, how much does it cost Utah taxpayers each year to address homelessness?
It's a great question. We haven't really seen a spike in the number of people experiencing homelessness. Now, part of this is because a lot of these eviction moratorium protections, I think, have kept people in their housing units right now. Those protections and the related things expire at some point, so there is some danger out there. And the amount of population that Jim highlighted that are doubled up is always a concern, and that's probably been increasing. And those are the precarious households that usually become homeless. It's a couple events away from eviction that usually where homelessness occurs. So we haven't seen it yet, but it is a concern. As far as how much it costs, and, you know, we haven't looked at this recently. Jim helped us look at this years ago. We looked at some of our long-term homeless populations, how much it costs for them to just be on the streets or in the shelters, and they access a lot of expensive services in a way that takes care of their issues at the time, but they're not the most efficient way in the marketplace to receive healthcare and other types of social services. And we've seen anywhere from, $30,000 for somebody who's chronically homeless per year that gets spent on emergency service response, maybe emergency room visits, shelter costs, street outreach, fire, police response, all of those types of things are very expensive. The challenge is they're not really, we start to intervene on the totally support, that it's much less expensive to serve somebody with housing and support services than it is to let them be homeless. It gets to be a challenging situation, and it is costly, and other communities have done these types of studies and seen upwards of $50,000 for some of these long-term homeless individuals to be on the street.
Interesting. Yeah. Mike, we've got a question, and I'll start with you, but I'll ask both Jonathan and Jim to give a short response. See any silver linings to this COVID-19 as it relates to housing in our state?
I do. It's putting in the forefront some of the gaps that we have been missing in the past or not paying attention to. With regards to housing, there isn't sufficient housing. The pandemic has identified again the issues dealing with those families that are doubling up and because of lost wages, the impact of COVID on the families because they're doubling up. Housing is related to health. I'll say that again. And health is related to housing. And as we go forward, we have to look at health as becoming a part of not only our housing stability, but those who are familiar with this social determinants of health understand that there's a relationship there. Recognized in the past. So as we look at housing, we spend a lot of time on rehabilitation of existing housing. And we have evidence where some of this mitigation efforts on existing housing improves families' health in their households.
Yeah.
So, and the preservation as well. Preservation is a big piece of this. Preservation of existing affordable housing. And Jonathan and I and Jen, I'm sure, are all aware of this, that we can't let our guards down just looking at production. We have to look at it more holistically.
Jonathan, Mike's given us some silver linings. Do you have any to add, or do you just want to give a thumbs up to what he shared?
I'm going to classify mine as one silver lining and then one big area of concern. Silver lining is workers probably have a lot more choices in the future of where they can live. I think one of the things we've noticed in this COVID-19 environment is that a lot of people can perform the same work living, 200 miles away from Salt Lake City than they could working in Salt Lake City. I know that's true for my workforce. So I think, people that have those opportunities probably are going to have more choices in the future, and maybe we have a little more dispersion of where people can live and not so much stress on concentrating along some of these urban corridors as a possibility. I am gravely concerned about the challenge of lower income workers who are very disproportionately affected by COVID-19 right now. And those jobs are not remote and they don't pay much, and they're the ones that are affected most. So I'm really concerned about the lower end of that population. I think, homeowners that have remote work opportunities probably have some better opportunities in the future. That's a silver lining. But that challenge of the lower income folks that really need that affordable housing in a site-specific location, still very concerned about that.
Yeah, appreciate you sharing that. A dark cloud for sure. Jim, you want to answer the silver lining? Then I've got one more quick question and we'll do some closing comments.
Okay. Well, I think Mike and Jonathan covered that well. I think the silver lining might be that COVID-19 is shining a brighter light on some of these inequities and the inequality we have. And I think that is certainly a benefit. But like with Jonathan, I still worry about some segments of the market that where there's been really a disproportionate impact.
Yeah. Jim, and then just quickly, I think this is best for you, but Jonathan Hardy can jump in too, but Senate Bill 34 had a provision that dealt with accessory dwelling units, ADUs. Just wondering, how widely has this option been adopted at the city level? Are we seeing more ADUs? Have they become a big part of the plans?
Well, Mike's office has done a study on this. Jake.
Oh, Mike, let's go to you.
Yes. Actually, this was probably one of the most utilized responses from those municipalities responding to the Senate Bill 34. It's one thing to say you're going to do it. It's another thing that you're doing it. However, it could address a lot of issues of immediate housing opportunities. And we have done a study across the state with the assistance of the League of Cities and Towns. And most areas are enthused about getting into ordinance and zoning for ADUs in their communities. It's not been readily used, but I think we're going to see over the course of time how they implement ADUs. And it's also a response to needs on aging in place and the needs to have granny flats. There's already a lot of housing out there that have basements that are unused and they're finished and could be converted into ADUs. So it's, I think, going to be up to municipalities to come up with the zoning that's going to allow ADUs and maybe some incentives from local jurisdictions as well to help with that conversion.
Yeah, Mike, I love your point that it's one thing to say something and another to do something. Okay, we are down to just a few more minutes in the program. I'm going to start with Jonathan, then go to Michael and give Jim the last word. And Jonathan, the question's this, you get to take maybe, 45 seconds or so on it. November 3rd, we've got a big election. We've got elections for mayors, county commissioners, county council representatives, state legislators, and an open governor seat. So Jonathan, the question is, what advice would you give to these elected officials to help with housing affordability in our state?
Well, I think one, that with growth, which almost every politician supports, come these types of challenges that we're talking about. That usually it's on the flip side that you get good growth, tremendous growth. It's benefiting a lot of folks in our community. Housing prices rises. It's all great if you own a house and you're part of that market. But the real challenge for our future is our population growth, a lot of it internal. And how do we support that with available, opportunities for our kids? It's also an economic development issue. Do we have a workforce that can support based on our housing market? I think those are real issues that don't always come to the forefront when we talk about economic development and growth, and they're critical issues to solve along the way, because it's very difficult to do after the fact, as we're seeing from many years of this issue. And we need to help support a labor supply for the construction market. I mean, even if we had a lot of zoning opportunities, we have some limitations in the builder market that really couldn't create a lot more units, which is what we need in the future. So those are a couple, tidbits, I think.
Jonathan, I'm going to interpret that you're saying to Chris Peterson or Spencer Cox, whoever wins, growth is complicated. You better think about all of the tenets of growth.
Right.
To address affordable housing. Mike, what advice would you give to these new electeds?
Well, I'm going to want to see stronger leadership with regards to housing, affordable housing. The last two legislative sessions with regard to the two Senate Bill 34, strong support for funding from the legislature and coming away with little. We're in a situation where the market is not going to correct itself anytime soon. And so there's going to need to be some involvement with government and helping to provide the inducements to move forward with housing and address some of the impediments that we see come up all the time. If it's zoning, if it's funding, otherwise, it's going to take some time beyond our lifetimes, I think, for most of us here to see that turn around. We can't build ourselves out. The builders are telling us that. And so...
Okay.
That's what I have to say and share.
Jim, we've got 1 minute. We started with you. Let's give you the last word.
Okay. Well, I agree with both Jonathan and Mike, what they've said. We are lucky right now because we have both the civic community, the business community, and we have the legislature. That is really unusual. In the number of years I've been working on this issue, it was just the advocates, the nonprofit advocacy groups who were urging policies and programs would help those with affordable housing and housing affordability. Those are two terms that get mixed up a bit. Housing affordability refers to all housing types across all income spectrum and price spectrum. affordable housing is used for generally for low to moderate income households, that housing that is affordable to those households. And a Brookings expert on housing says that affordable housing is an income problem. Housing affordability is a policy problem. And that's one thing we don't talk enough about. So my advice to the next politician, the governor, and others is we need higher incomes. Get
jobs here. Very good.
This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wynowens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your producer and host of this program. As always, thanks for listening.